And I resisted. Saying, yes, I see you have lost. See the bottle.
There's another one.
And the one, from the one I saw.
They're sticking with the advisory. And then.
Even if I had the intent, you know, those rules would take advantage of.
The Senate Judiciary and Public Safety Committee will come to order. For the record, this is Thursday, March 1st, 2012. And let the record reveal that we do have a quorum for the committee. The first bill today is Senate File 1283 from Senator Benson. Senator Benson, is this your first time before the Senate Judiciary Committee?
No, Mr. Chair and committee members, so you don't have to do the freshman hazing.
Just delay that previous communication we had between our offices. Senator Benson, your subject matter is about State Capitol Security Advisory Committee, or the formation of. Why don't you proceed whenever you're ready?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. If I could have somebody move Senate File 1283.
Sarah Benson, we'll be doing that later after your presentation.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought we would move it before we discussed. Then can I move the author's amendment?
Yes. A4? Well, we'll have someone move the author's amendment.
I appreciate it.
Sarah Benson, this is not the original committee that this bill has gone to.
Okay.
So it cannot be an author's amendment.
All right.
You will have to sell us on the idea first.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is my home for Health and Human Services. I'm far too used to this table being my home table. The A4 amendment amends the bill to shrink the size of the advisory committee from its current 9 members to 6, yet keep the stakeholders as advisors to the committee.
I'm sorry, Senator Benson, could you repeat what you said?
Let me just begin with the bill. Mr. Chair and committee members, Senate File 1283 is a provision that provides for changes to our capital security in a small sense and in a larger sense, a review of capital security standards. The first provision of the bill provides for the State Patrol to provide security coverage for officials other than the governor after a consultation with the governor's office. This is limited coverage for a specific threat and only within available resources, and there's been no opposition to this provision of the bill. The second major provision of the bill is the establishment of an advisory committee on the Capital Area Security. For members' information, Capital Area Security encompasses not only the Capitol, but its surrounding buildings, all the way over to the History Center. It is actually defined in statute. The advisory committee is currently slated to consist of 9 members. I have the A4 amendment that would shrink it to 6 members appointed as follows: the lieutenant governor, a majority and minority Senate member, a majority and minority member of the House, a designee from the Chief Justice, and the advisory responsibilities would be performed by the Commissioners of Administration and Public Safety and the CAP Board, along with the Sergeants at Arms of the respective Senate and House. And so with that, Mr. Chair, I would have someone move the A4 amendment.
I would like to have counsel direct our attention to what is in our jurisdiction on this particular bill. Even though we're addressing the A4 amendment, it's important to know that so it puts it in our proper context for our discussion.
Mr. Chairman, members, I did a summary of what I saw as the key judiciary issues
I mean, I guess Section 1, because it's Commissioner of Public Safety and State Patrol, the committee can kind of look at it, but the main items really the committee would be concerned about are in the advisory committee language. If you look at page 4, line 1, there's just a statement there that the committee is subject to the open meeting law. And then subdivision 4 is data practices.
All right. Senator Newman?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I would move the A4 amendment.
Is there any discussion on the A4 amendment? Senator Lass.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Benson, what's the purpose of the amendment?
Mr. Chair and Senator Lass, the purpose of the amendment is to focus membership on those public servants who have a responsibility for looking out for the well-being of the public, of the staff who serves us here, for keeping the Capitol accessible but keeping it secure. And so while we add advisory roles for those who would execute the functions, the key responsibilities need to lie with the representatives of the public.
Senator Lass, before any further, why don't we have counsel explain the amendment and the purpose of it? That may help you with answering your question.
Mr. Chairman, members, I think as Senator Benson just pointed out, the first part is to pare down the membership of the advisory committee. So under the current language of the bill, the commissioner of Administration and Public Safety and the Sergeants-at-Arms of the House and Senate are actually members of the advisory committee. And under this, they would not be members, but there's a reference to the committee being required to consult with them as well as the Capital Area Architectural and Planning Board. And then I'll just point out there's one other little piece on the amendment on page 1, line 19. It deletes some language in the bill that I thought was unnecessary. It's general language under the Data Practices Act that would apply anyway. And given the fact that they're subject to the Data Practices Act, there's no reason to include this. And I thought the cross-references in particular are somewhat confusing and not inclusive enough.
Senator Lass, further questions?
Mr. Chairman, yeah. Perhaps the questions for counsel. Looks like the advisory committee meets, its duties are to meet and to report, but they don't have any substantive decision-making authority. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Lass, yes, that's my understanding. If you look, like on page 3, the report would include draft legislation to implement recommendations starting on page 3, line 30, but they would not actually have any authority to implement anything on their own.
Sure. And Mr. Chairman?
Senator Lass.
And to counsel, is there any advisory committee members, are they paid for their service in any way? Or is this just a streamlining effort?
Mr. Chairman, members, I don't believe they'd be paid. These are all the members that are on here now are already state employees, so I'm assuming this is something that they would do. This is just part of their duties.
Any further questions?
So, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Lass.
So this amendment, would it have any impact on the fiscal note? Sounds like it would not.
Mr. Turner?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Lass, no, it would not.
And then, Mr. Chairman, the only other question that I have is why is this committee being called upon to make this judgment call on this amendment? I assume there's a different committee that has primary jurisdiction over this particular aspect of the bill.
Senator Lass, when I was reviewing the bill before committee, we had discussion of whether or not Department of Public Safety would, what kind of role Department of Public Safety would have on the involvement with an advisory committee. And as we looked at the previous original bill, where it was specified that the commissioner of Department Public Safety or a designee would be involved in it, that's really what's triggered the involvement of our jurisdiction. And as we began to look at the membership, the people that were representing the administration in key disciplines like public safety were really mentioned as a consulting role from kind of the very beginning. And as we looked over the wording in the bill, it didn't quite seem to fit what the intent was at the very beginning. Just as a little bit of a brief history that we haven't included in the presentation, Senator Benson, as well as myself, Democrat members of both the House and Senate, majority members in the House and Senate, were all involved in an ad hoc committee to analyze the security issues of the state capitol complex. Not only the Capitol building, but the state office building, the tunnel system, the Supreme Court building, as well as the Veteran Affairs building, and Department of Transportation. This was as a result of a focus of our security based on the recent shooting about a year ago that happened to Congresswoman Giffords in, was it Arizona? And it kind of reminded policymakers that we don't have a formal way of determining what our security is in the building, and much less anywhere else. I've been in service here for 24 years, and I've never even experienced a fire drill. And so as I look at that type of thing, I think there is a need for a group of members of the administration as well as the legislative body, and in this case a member of the Supreme Court, to be involved in focusing on, in a nonpartisan way, the security issues that we all work in, not only for our own safety, but for the safety of the public that comes here now and then. And as we know, there can be accidents that can occur, fires could occur, a leak of natural gas could occur. We could also have other threats that could come into the building in a variety of different ways. That really is the impetus of the whole bill itself. But the reason why we're having it before the committee was essentially the involvement, as it was originally written, the Department of Public Safety brought it, triggered it to come here. We have not yet voted on the amendment. Senator Newman renews the A4 amendment. Is there further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Senator Benson, is there any further discussion?
Mr. Chair, thank you very much for the summary. It was actually a continuing part of my presentation. A little more broadly, the Ad Hoc Committee on Capitol Security did include the Sergeants at Arms. It included the State Patrol officers that provide security for the governor. It included members of the Department of, or representatives from the Department of Administration, minority and majority members, and it was our decision that it was beyond the scope of an ad hoc committee to make firm recommendations as to what security changes should be made in the Capitol. And so we recommended the formation of this advisory committee to work with the Commissioner of Public Safety and the governor. And members, since the time this bill was first brought, we have heard much discussion about the need for renovation at the Capitol. And if we're going to go through the steps of renovating the Capitol, it's important that security be part of that conversation to ensure that we protect the public that comes here, that we protect our staff that work for us every day in a way that allows access to the public but protects them from perceivable threats. Do we even know what we do if a tornado is coming towards the Capitol? Do we know what we do if there's a fire in the Capitol? What happens to the school groups? What's the plan? Somebody needs to take that responsibility, and that's what this advisory committee was established to do. And with that, I open for questions.
Thank you, Senator Benson. Senator Ingebrigtsen, do you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Benson, for doing this.
One of the questions that I have, and I've got some concerns with regards to the different entities that are providing the security at the Capitol. Has there been any discussion about the sharing of information or the lack thereof of intelligence or possible problems? Somebody might be coming. Can we share that amongst each other? Are you finding some roadblocks there? And if you are, I would hope that this committee addresses those.
Senator Benson. And
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebretson, it's been a while since this committee met, but during our discussions, the sergeants-at-arms for the House and the Senate consult regularly. The State Patrol is in on those meetings, and as needed, other protection forces are brought in. The National Guard actually did a comprehensive evaluation prior to the RNC in 2009, and the members of security here at the Capitol and the State Office Building are aware of that. So there is ad hoc communication as needed, and our sergeants do a very good job for us and being aware of the public need for protection, but it is not a comprehensive view, and it's not completely assessed.
Thank you. Follow up. I really appreciate that because know the importance of when somebody's on the campus and or they're suspicious of somebody on the campus is we have to throw away our areas. What I'm saying is we protect our areas. Are we, the different sharing of it. Again, once again, it goes to the point of sharing intelligence. In other words, if there's somebody potentially on the campus, everybody, no matter what color uniform they're wearing, has to now put away their whatever it is, rank and file, and start communicating. And I hear that there might be potentially some issues with that, and I would really want to emphasize that group follow up on that because it's very important. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Benson, I did like the amendment. It dealt with some of the questions I had. But in terms of the ad hoc committee that led to this bill, did you get testimony from the Capitol Security? I didn't hear that because, some of the things I know they've done, run practice drills. And I guess part of what I was interested in came off of what Senator Ingebrigtsen said. As you're looking through those is what, and we haven't had some of those plans for tornadoes and things that I think are good points. How do we define out what do we need to know, what should we know when there's credible threats? And I always do find it interesting to come back to Minnesota. I've gone to many state capitals and taking a tour of their security, and we leave ours very open and haven't had a problem. And so we must be doing something right, we hope. But have those issues been kind of addressed and talked about?
And
Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Jungbauer, we did have the sergeants were involved in all these meetings. The governor's security team were involved in the meetings. We brought in an individual from the National Guard to talk about their assessment. And so there's a pretty broad look at what has been done and what is in place that's doing a pretty good job. But the conclusion was this is beyond the scope of an ad hoc committee and really direct the Department of Public Safety through the governor's office to take a comprehensive view in conjunction with transport. Security at the transportation building is different than judiciary. Are the needs there being met? What is different about the Capitol than other places? So it was beyond our scope, and so we moved forward with a more formal organization.
Senator Jungbauer, one thing I want to make absolutely clear, and that is there is a very effective force within the Capitol grounds and the Capitol complex to handle emergencies. But over time, I think we in the legislature have kind of stepped back, and we're not really knowledgeable of what is always there. A few people are, but not a concerted focus. And this would help in creating a dialogue back and forth. Some of the more eyes adds to greater security, and the greater the discussion we have could also add to the discussion of how we are prepared. It could deal with the plain simple hours in a day the manpower that is at our disposal, the ones that may not be. How does that integrate with other outside police departments, law enforcement, EMT type response? Is that coordinated? And in light of at least the shooting in Arizona, we wanted to make sure that we have covered our bases adequately to provide safety for the public. Senator Junkbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Benson. And sounds like, Mr. Chair, you've got a good handle on it as well, being part of that. And I know we as legislators a lot of times can bring in things that maybe even security folks aren't thinking about. I mean, one of the things that came off top of my head in thinking about this was, working with an engineering firm, when you're designing parks today, for example, they know a lot of new things about security. And you know, since part of our Capitol grounds is park-like, is that the kind of things you envision? Is just trying to put people with different backgrounds to be able to bring those things together and just offer some different, because I didn't see anything about necessarily backgrounds, but I hope we're bringing in a lot of different things so that you're not saying to security people, we're trying to do security, but we want to bring other ideas in place so as we rebuild and redo things, we're shaping it for security and beauty and access.
Senator Benson.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Jungbauer, if you look on page 4, line 5, it talks about seeking advice from people who have done this, public colleges and universities, courts, private sector. The idea was to ensure that this advisory commission would bring in experts to make sure security was done correctly. And let's not think of security just in terms of lights and sirens. Let's think of it in terms of how we plan, how we be planful, how we train, how we have our staff engaged, how we have the public informed. And that's why we're looking broadly to experts. But somebody ultimately needs to be held accountable, and that's why there's the limited group at the top who's responsible for security at the Capitol.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Any
so
other
much.
Questions? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to speak for or against the bill?
Yeah.
Senator Neumeister.
Yeah.
Senator Neumeister. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this is my first time before your committee this year, so I'm glad to be before your committee.
This is the first time, Senator Neumeister? But this, not the first time you've ever spoken
no,
in
no,
front
of
us.
No, not historically.
I don't think you're a senator
Mr.
yet.
Mr. Chairman.
And I'm sorry I demeaned you. I called you a senator. I'm sorry about that. Mr. Neumeister.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this bill was heard last year. There was a fair amount of discussion and controversy about some aspects of it, particularly around the principle that this is the people's house. And particularly with the shutdown with the people's house, it became more magnified that for people to get access to influence you, the elected officials, is very important. So where you put your parking lots, how many you decide to permit to come up in front of the Capitol to demonstrate, how the spaces you have in the Capitol where they can catch a senator like many of the groups here today are doing is very important. And that's one of the issues that I have concerns about, that that aspect should not be compromised without some public discussion. And that's one of the reasons why at least you have an open meeting process, where under the open meeting some things, when you're discussing security type things, the meeting can be closed. But there is some information to the public to have some knowledge about it. I described to you some aspects of what, in regards to some things, might be of interest to the public. Let's say, for example, that there was a change in the permits process. Let's say there are certain parts of the Capitol area where you can only have so many people testify. Maybe there is a change of policy about conceal and carry in the public building here in the Capitol. One of the things that I've think is important for those type of discussions to be heard. But what I've learned, because after the Capitol was shut down in June, I asked around who really made the decision. And particularly when I wanted to see my elected official, and I was told by the elected official, sorry, Mr. Neumeister, but I can't even escort you while everyone else was working, but I couldn't be escorted even in the SOB. There's this dichotomy between the Department of Administration and the capital security itself that comes up with those kinds of decisions. So the things that I described about who makes where parking lots, like over north of the SOB building, it was a great place for citizens to park, but all of a sudden that became employee parking. To where the tunnels are now being closed a couple of years ago, where the person that parks along down the street wants to enter in the Centennial. So my question, in a general way and in describing in a broad way, will those kinds of discussions be a part of this group? And when I see, or other changes in security-related policies or practices on page 3, lines 329 and 330, that's my impression, that there won't be some arbitrary decisions made by admin or the security that could impact our ability, the public's ability, to come and visit you and to do our First Amendment rights. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, those are just some concerns. There's more openness, more transparency, more accountability than as the bill was introduced last year. And Senator Benson, Mr. Chairman, would know that that did receive a lot of publicity, and a lot of folks came out of the thing on that issue. And it still retains that thing. But at least I raise a question or a point of view on some of the other matters.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Some of the comments you made are outside of the scope of our jurisdiction, placement of parking lots and things. This is just to put a sign of approval on a organization that would give recommendation to others, and it's nothing more intended than that. But thank you for your comments.
Thank you.
Anyone else who wishes to speak for or against the bill? Hearing none, is there further discussion? Hearing none, Sarah Newman moves that Senate File 1283 as amended be recommended to pass and move to Finance.
So moved.
All those in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion does prevail. Thank you, Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I've been told I didn't speak efficiently into the microphone, so that bill will be going to Finance Committee. Mm-hmm. Senator Ortman, Senate File 1664. There you are. Senator Ortman, you're going to talk to us about solid waste today.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I've heard Mortman and Tortman, but it's Ortman with an O. Members, thank you for hearing Senate File 1664. Other than the fact that there are some folks here to testify against it, it's a pretty straightforward, non-controversial bill. this is a bill that I introduced many years ago, and we had a hearing on it, and we had a very informative discussion, and I hope that's what we'll have here today with respect to this bill. Actions have consequences, and what this bill is about cities and counties, municipalities that have made a decision to limit the number of businesses that can compete in their community in the garbage business, the mixed municipal solid waste. I know that sounds like a pretty big technical term, but we're talking about garbage here. And so imagine you live in a city where you have all kinds of competition, and you can go from one hauler to the next to suit your needs for service, to suit your budget. You can find a hauler that will provide for you, and they might be able to compete with other haulers in the community for your business. In Minnesota, it is now legal for the cities and the counties to decide that they can control how many licenses to authorize to garbage haulers to conduct business within their communities. And so imagine if you have 5 or 6 haulers in your community one day, but the city decides that for whatever reasons, they only want to have 3 haulers conducting business within the city. These decisions do get made across the state. Well, what happens if your hauler number 4 or 5 that happens to have quite a bit of business in that community, but the city has just effectively put you out of business in that city? That's why I started out with the conversation that actions have consequences. We have an awful lot of small haulers in the state of Minnesota that are being put out of business. small businesses that have worked very hard to build a clientele, and now because of their actions, the cities or the municipalities, counties, have decided for their reasons that they're no longer going to permit these folks to do business within the community. For them, that can be devastating in their business. We have some folks here that will testify, but what this bill does is it says, city or county, if you're going to make that decision and you're going to put hauler number 4 or 5 out of business, you have to accept the fact that now you have taken something from them, you've taken their business, and this is essentially a government condemnation proceeding. And these haulers then, hauler number 4 or 5, should be able to come back and call what is an inverse condemnation proceeding, which would be, the city has taken away our business, we want to bring an action in district court to recover our losses for the fact that the business has been taken away. So that's what Senate File 1664 attempts to accomplish. Mr. Chair, there is an A2 amendment, and I'd like to offer that as an author's amendment, if I may.
Senator Ortman moves the A2 amendment as an author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. If I could just quickly review the bill so that you know what it attempts to do here. Subdivision 1 authorizes the cause of action that we've just talked about. It does not provide any kind of recovery. That's up to the district court. There would have to be proof. There would have to be hearings and proceedings. The cities and the counties can oppose that action and can oppose any kind of recovery that they might be required to provide. And Subdivision 2 talks about a statute of limitations. If you look at the A2 amendment that we just adopted, the first two are a couple of basic technical changes that just clarifies that when we say a person, we also mean a corporation or a business. The third section here, 1.6 of working off the A2 amendment now, says that if a company is already under contract with one of these cities or a county, if the contract expires and there's no taking of a business because there was a contractual relationship. And then lastly, beginning at line 1.1, there is a very short time frame for bringing an inverse condemnation proceeding. Here it would be 6 months from the time that the waste collection services are alleged to have been taken. So we're asking these haulers to act very quickly and let folks know that they have a proceeding that they'd like to bring in district court for inverse condemnation. Again, this doesn't authorize any awards. It just says they can bring the action in the district court. So with that explanation, if there are questions specifically about the language, I'd be happy to answer them. But we also have quite a few testifiers here who would like to speak about the merits of this bill.
Thank you, Senator Ortman. There is quite a few people that wish to give testimony. Perhaps we could hold questions until after testimony. We've got two people that wish to speak in favor, and we have, I think, 7 that wish to speak opposed. Because of the interest in time, I'll give both sides 20 minutes total, aggregate, and then we'll close discussion, and then we'll have our policy discussion after that. So if Mr. Tennis is in the room and Mr. Berkopek, come to the table, and you can give us further testimony regarding the bill. Which one would like to go first? Mr. Tennis?
Hi, my name is...
Could you identify yourself for the record?
Yes, my name is Willie Tennis. My brother and I own a company called Tennis Sanitation. We're located in St. Paul Park. Good morning.
You're welcome.
Everyone. Just a little background about our company. My dad and uncle started it back in 1966. Some of you probably recall back then you had the old burning barrels in the backyard. And that's how we used to pick up until the early 70s. Anyway, my dad and uncle both worked full-time at the St. Paul Union Stockyards, and then they started the trash business. And about a year into it, my uncle got transferred down to Worthington. So I was 13, so my dad asked me if I wanted to be his helper. So my dad and I then, and then my brother in 78, we had the opportunity to take over a local hauler that lived up the street from us. So then my brother got involved. And then in 88, our parents retired. And now my brother and I have our wives, and I have a son and daughter involved, so does my brother. And we've got employees that have been with us for over 20 years. And we've been fortunate enough over the years to keep continuing growing. We offer very personal service to our customers. I personally do sales. If somebody's moving into a house, whatever, I personally go and talk to them. And it's just one of the perks of our company. And so anyway, we've gone through all the changes from the burning to the non-burning to the recycling, composting, all that. We've conquered all that. We haven't had a problem continuing to grow our business. But just recently, with the city of Maplewood deciding to go to the one hauler, that took away 20% of our business. And so with that, I mean, unfortunately, we're going to have to lay off some of our employees. And that not only affects them, their families, and all the 46 years we've been in business, we've never had to lay anybody off. So this is going to be a first time for us. And thing we're worried about is the other 80% of our business, 70% of it is all in three cities. And what happens if these other three cities would do the same thing? 46 years of hard work, we'd be out of business. We'd have nothing. And we're just asking that we feel we should be compensated for our hard work and servicing our customers. I mean, in Maplewood, residents came by the hundreds saying that they wanted to keep it the way it was. So we feel that we're servicing the people very well and doing a good job, and we would like to continue to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Tennis. Mr. Berkopek.
Hello.
Welcome to the committee. Could you identify yourself for the record?
My name is Mike Berkopek, and I'm with Ace Solid Waste. We're located up in Ramsey, Minnesota. Our company has been around since 1955. It was started by a post-World War II vet, similar to Willie's story. And through that time, it's been through a couple of ownership changes, all local owners. And currently, the company is owned by Andy Schweitzer, who lives in New Brighton, Minnesota. I guess I just want to start with what Willie said is Maplewood took 20% of his business, just gone. I guess the point we want to try to make today is I think we all know that businesses have value. If they didn't, you know, where would the economy be? What would be the incentive for anybody to get into business if a business did not have value? So we think that this bill is about recognizing the value of a business and its value to the community. Today, in deference to the committee, we're only going to have two people speak in favor, but that doesn't mean we don't have a whole bunch of people who are very much in favor of this. As a matter of fact, if the haulers in the room wouldn't quickly stand up, and all of these guys are haulers in the community, Gene and George and Brett and Bobby and Andy, and I think there's probably a couple more that I may have missed, are people, local haulers, who are very, very concerned about the future of their business. Thank you. They work hard every day to provide value to their customers. And actually, there's probably a few more that would have wanted to be here, but there's not a parking lot for garbage trucks near the Capitol. And these are people who are working on the street. I know Gene, for example, had to make some arrangements so somebody else was driving his truck today. So these are real people, and I'd ask that you don't paint us broadly with that utility brush. Since before, you know, government even cared about garbage, we were out there providing a valuable community service. It's always been hauler to customer without government interference, a one-to-one relationship. Hauler direct without government interference. Now, you know, we know obviously times have changed, and I think as Willie mentioned, we've changed with it. We've got new and innovative ways that we've serviced customers, and we've made significant investments of time, energy, and money to make the system better. We think we're like your favorite plumber, maybe your favorite lawn care company, or other service provider to your home. We are not a utility. Willie gave very good impact, a very good testimony on the impact of the takeover for his business. And if I had everybody else talk about the impacts on their business, it would be a very long list of folks. But one person I want to mention is Gene from Gene's disposal. Throughout the process in Maplewood, and I was there with him, it was really very heart-wrenching. And think about this. You know, Gene bought the business. He bought the business from his parents. They didn't just give it to him. He bought it from them. As a matter of fact, he's still paying his mom for the business. And obviously, as you can imagine, his obligation to his mom to enjoy her retirement is pretty important. And he's not real excited that he may have to go back to his mom and say, well, you know, I can't keep making payments to you because the government took our customers. We just don't think, in his mind, and he said it to me, he says, I think that's stealing. And I tend to agree. In the very last public hearing in Maplewood, he couldn't leave the podium. And it wasn't because necessarily he didn't have anything more to say. He just didn't know what to do. Because here they are, somebody taking his customers, and he had no power to try to save his customers, unlike in the competitive marketplace, which he's operated in for very many years. Kind of going back to Willie and Greg from Tennis Sanitation, they were granted a license to haul in the city of Maplewood. I mean, they're relatively new in the city of Maplewood. They came in, they were granted a license, they complied with all the requirements, just like maybe a plumber or a house builder in town. They built the business. Their customers love them. And their customers repeatedly told the city to stay away. Don't get between them and tennis. And he said hundreds. I was there. It was thousands. It was thousands. But the city really didn't care. They took his business away anyway. 10 years ago, they granted him a license, welcomed him to the community, was a valuable service provider in the community, and then because they decided to change the system, they pulled the rug out from under him. It's a significant impact. In Maplewood, 7 haulers were displaced. Tennis Sanitation, Jeans Disposal, Highland Sanitation, Maroney's, Veolia Environmental, and Waste Management. That's 5 local businesses and 2 national haulers. It's just not fair. And in my mind, it throws to the gutter the fact that businesses have value. It's just not right. Given the history of what's been happening at this government takeover, this organized collection thing, and the facts that residents have unilaterally been on our side, this has happened before. Communities have tried to do this. And generally, because residents have been on our side and we provided value in the community, it hasn't happened. We fought, obviously. People, the residents, the citizens understood, and we won. Well, Maplewood has destroyed our hopes and dreams of being successful in business. We are now in a situation where uncertainty in our business has increased tenfold. You know, local haulers, we use local banks to finance our businesses. I'm not sure what we're going to tell them. You know, small business owners, they give personal guarantees on bank loans. You don't get a bank loan without putting your life on the line. The risk is huge. And the law, as it's currently written, makes repayment uncertain. And Maplewood really scared us in that area. So we're not sure what to do, and obviously that's why we're here today. Small businesses like ours, we think we deserve the certainty that if the government ever takes the business we've earned, that there will be an opportunity for fair compensation. So in my mind, if you believe in limited government, you obviously should favor this bill. It's fairly obvious. It doesn't stop cities from government takeover of the garbage business, but it does make them recognize the cost businesses have incurred over many years of risk-taking and hard work to deliver value to their customers, their employees, their families, themselves, and their bankers. In my mind, if you're part of the opposition and think government-run collection is a better mousetrap, you should also favor this bill. You will hear testimony that organized collection is a difficult process. The current process is difficult. Well, there's really 3 basic reasons for this. First, residents unilaterally have spoken loud and clear packed city council chambers, that the value equation that's being proposed doesn't work. Saving a few bucks a month and getting more government and less choice just isn't worth it. This bill doesn't address that. Secondly, there's always claims of savings on road wear and tear. It's a dubious claim. As a matter of fact, when you look at the cost per mile among cities that have government-run collection versus those with market-driven open systems, there is no correlation. A few garbage trucks don't make a difference. It's environmental conditions and subsurface soils that drive road costs. I have the data to prove that. Finally, and this is really the meat of the matter here, organized collection is difficult because you're taking someone's business using the police powers of government. Unlike the marketplace, I can't compete against the power of law. We probably will continue to argue about citizens' desire and road wear and tear. Those continue to be open questions. But this bill resolves the biggest roadblock that makes organized collection difficult, and you should be in favor of it. In our minds, it's a societal fairness issue. If you believe in government regulation of the garbage government running of the garbage collection business, you have to believe in just compensation. So, in conclusion, regardless, if this bill does not pass, the haulers in this room are sitting here because they want answers to a few questions. Who's going to take responsibility for my truck payments if government takes my business? Who's going to tell my employees they're out of a job through no fault of their own or no fault of mine as an owner? Who's going to explain to their families of these company owners that they've spent countless hours of work, sleepless nights, and stressful days were all just a waste of time? These are the things that are important to us, and we'd appreciate your consideration and voting for this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. The next series of people giving testimony will be those opposing the bill. There's a number of people here. We'll start with Mark Sather and Craig Johnson, if they could approach the table. And what I'd like to remind everyone giving testimony to keep the comments focused on the real intent of the bill, and that is the focus on the writing of an action or the filing of an action in district court and the issues that are outlined in the bill. Mr. Sather, would you want to begin?
Mr. Chair, members of the commission.
Could you identify yourself for
yes,
the record?
Yes, my name is Mark Sather. I'm the city manager of White Bear Lake, Minnesota, and I'm also on the board of the Metropolitan Cities, or Metro Cities. I'm going to keep my remarks short to meet your time schedule, but I'd like to, first off, as a city manager of White Bear Lake, strongly support your Amendment 2A, I believe, because White Bear Lake has been an organized collection city. I found contracts upon my arrival there 28 years ago that go back to 1928. So our contract is up for renewal. It will be up for bids next year. We wanted to make sure that we weren't subjected to the inverse condemnation language if that was passed. But it was referenced that cities enter organized collection for their own reasons. And as a person who's worked in three Minnesota cities, all that had single haulers, I'd like to explain a couple of the reasons that we do it. One is to protect the public investment that we have in our streets and in our infrastructure. With all due respect to the previous speaker, it is climatic conditions and it's other things, but in the springtime when we put road restrictions on major things, we really can't put road restrictions on every residential street. And a loaded garbage packer going down the street is about the heaviest thing that goes down there, save maybe a school bus full of children. And if we can limit that or reduce it, we're going to help protect that street. So rather than having several trucks, we've heard cases in some cities, maybe as many as four or five a week going down a single block, we have one. And and actually, if you factor in the recycling, which you're going to have to do, actually there would be two, but in other cases there would be maybe 8 to 10. Another primary reason is to protect the public safety. These are big, heavy vehicles, and I know they practice safe practices, but anytime you can keep big, heavy vehicles out of residential streets or reduce the number, there's an advantage. It's to comply with the law, and we ask you to carefully consider that. State statute requires municipalities to make certain that all of its residential properties have collection. There's obviously a variety of means in which to do it, but the most efficient that we have found is to have a master contract through which each of those homes are collected. And then fourthly, and also just as important, is on behalf of our residents, we're trying to run services, municipal services, at the lowest possible rate, and this type of service provides us. We have a great deal of concern for independent businessmen, independent entrepreneurs. I've been in White Bear Lake. We have rebid our contract 3 times, opened it up. We've actually, under statutes, been able to continue it through negotiations. Each time we rebid it, it's been a small hauler like those that were introduced here earlier. Fortunately or unfortunately, I guess maybe for both parties, those contracts have been built. They've built the service, and they've sold those to larger haulers right now. We now have a large national, perhaps multinational firm, but their contract is up for bid. But each time we have actually opened up for bid, it has been a small hauler that has received it with stories very similar to what you heard before. So, we strongly oppose this proposed action. I've been involved through in eminent domain in several different instances where the costs can get way beyond what most parties would probably ever imagine. And under the new statutes regarding eminent domain, it makes it even worse. So it would effectively, in my opinion, prevent people from going to organized collection.
Thank you, Mr. Sather. Mr. Johnson.
Thank you.
Identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities. Appreciate your time today, and we will keep it brief. Mr. Sather represented most of the general concerns cities have with this. I wanted to hit on a couple specific ones and just give you the legal connections between this and the solid waste law that drives it, because while you're amending takings law here, the only thing that triggers it is how we choose to implement solid waste law. And in Chapter 115A, and Mr. Sather referred to it, 115A.941 actually says that cities over 1,000, townships over 5,000 population must provide solid waste collection for all garbage in their community. And we have 3 options. We can either provide it ourselves with municipal trucks and employees, we can put an organized collection system in place, or we can have an enforceable contract with penalties if people are not having their garbage collected properly and if the collectors aren't doing it properly, which is what is being referred to as open collection in this discussion. Changing the inverse condemnation law the way it's being proposed in this effectively makes it so a city cannot go back to doing either of the first of those two without a substantial cost to taxpayers. It's taxpayer money that would come out of that. And so it really eliminates those, even though the solid waste laws were written with a process that has 3 options. The one would really not be financially viable in a number of cases at this point. And there is no doubt that when a company has a loss of business in a community, that it affects them. I mean, when you lose 20% of your business, no one wants to see that happen. But I would hold that whenever there's a bid for a contract by a business, there's a risk that they don't win that low bid. And it could be a contract they've had for a long time, and now they don't have that business on the books anymore. So this is not a tremendously unique circumstance, except that state law mandates communities reach an arrangement for how garbage service will be provided in their community. So communities have different ways that they do it. In the 20 years that the organized collection hearing process has been in place, one community has gone all the way through that process and put organized collection in place. It's the Maplewood example you heard about. The others have all found other solutions along the way, maybe split their city into zones, done other things of that sort, made sure existing haulers could keep their share of the business. And in fact, if you look at the process required in 115A.94, it actually is a 6-month mandatory set of hearings. Every hauler that currently serves the community is required to be allowed at those meetings, and actually they have to opt out to not be a part of those negotiations. And the city cannot propose another option for organized collection unless a majority of the haulers decide they don't want to go along with an organized collection plan. So there is already a very long process that involves all of these parties, and only if no resolution can be reached would it go to the point that the Maplewood case got to. That's the one time it's happened. I would add one last point, Mr. Chair and members. This is not always up to the city or the township to decide. And I am making my comments both for the League of Cities, and I was the Minnesota Association of Townships shares our concerns on this legislation. I was asked to make note of that. In subdivision 5 of 115A.94, a county may by ordinance require the cities and towns within its jurisdiction to establish organized collection. So what that would now do is make it so a county, in operating the way they feel they are required by law to manage solid waste, would expose all of the other political subdivisions in that county to inverse condemnation claims. So we have very significant concerns with this, Mr. Chair. We do agree that there are costs and there are factors that need to be considered very carefully and that it should be avoided to do unnecessary harm to anyone's business. But we also have very strict responsibilities that we are expected to meet and regulated to meet, and need to have the flexibility and ability to do that as a community without it being so financially burdensome that it's really not a viable option. With that, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. The next
Mr.
few
Chair,
people. Yes.
With respect to that point, if I may.
Yes, Senator Lieberman.
I'm not sure whether it was clearly stated here, but what I heard Mr. Johnson say is that under 115A.941, there are three choices in how a city or township may organize. Either they can provide it themselves. Number two, they can have an organized collection. Or number three, they can have open services, open for anyone. And he said that it would be hard. They could not go back to one of the first two options if they were in the middle of open collection. That's not correct. And it wouldn't have an impact anywhere if there wasn't actually competition in the marketplace. Of course they can, but there may be some businesses that end up being put out of business like we're talking about here. And in those rare instances where there are, that's where this bill would have an application. It would be if they couldn't work things out, if there still were some competitors that weren't satisfied with the shift from open collection to organized or back to the city providing it, then there would be a potential cause of action. And I just want to make sure that folks understand the application.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, it is fair to say that there are other applications of it, but I would point out also that this has a much broader swath to it than just who's picking up garbage at the curb. It affects all municipal solid waste services, so transfer stations, operation of landfills, incinerators, all of those services, and whoever is contracted to do them fall under this. I would secondly add that we're thinking of this in the metro area example because we're talking about Maplewood. So the boundaries of the cities are pretty established here. They don't change frequently. But this is in effect statewide. We have a number of communities in this state where as their city grows and expands, the garbage service goes with it. Most of those places may not be under that city's organized collection system now, but they will be when the service is expanded. So we have that happening, for instance, in the city of St. Cloud. They municipally run their service. But when they add a new neighborhood to their city, it goes under that municipal service. That would now expose them to inverse condemnation claims and a judicial process just for expanding their service to the people who are now expecting city services as part of their residency in the city. It also affects cities that are expanding quickly and having new neighborhoods added in. The city of Shakopee, for instance, has this happening right now, where as they extend their sewer and water service to new neighborhoods, they extend their municipal garbage service with it, because they're all three treated as a city utility that's being extended to those people.
I'm going to make sure that we hold to the schedule here. We've got five more testifiers. The opponents have used up 8 minutes of their time. I did not count the recent dialogue here in that 8 minutes. So the next few people, Janice Callison and Mr. Joe Harris, and then after them, Mr. Dave Perkins and John Helmers will follow. But Ms. Callison, could you identify yourself for the record?
Good afternoon. Actually, I'm going to ask Commissioner Harris to go first, if that's
all
okay.
All right. Mr. Harris, or Commissioner Harris, would you identify yourself for the record,
yes,
please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Joe Harris. I'm a Dakota County Commissioner and a member of the Solid Waste Management Coordinating Board here in the metropolitan area. And I have had the honor of sitting on the Dakota County Board of Commissioners for 32 years. And as part of my responsibilities as a county commissioner, I have approved solid waste management plans for the county that are consistent with state laws that legislators have passed and governors have signed into law. All since the 1980 Waste Act was passed, that's when I became a commissioner in 1981, so I've watched it for 30-some years. You can imagine that solid waste management is an important issue for my county. We are the home to the two largest landfills in the state of Minnesota, Burnsville and Inver Grove Heights. And I am here today to oppose the inverse condemnation bill. Simply put, it is bad public policy to over-control how government needs to meet their statutory obligations related to the solid waste management services. And it is a bad idea that is proposed here to date, which is going to create a precedent that will allow other special interests to come to the legislature and seek special compensation in years ahead. Over the years, I have listened to and supported the many businesses, small and large, in Dakota County that have invested in solid waste management services. And throughout that time, I have consistently upheld my role as a commissioner to protect the public health and environment on behalf of the county residents and businesses. Creating an inverse condemnation law for solid waste services would change that carefully created public-private balance. My county would continue to assume the risks for the solid waste management, while the private sector would be able to prevent necessary improvements to the solid waste management system by threatening inverse condemnation legal actions. As a county commissioner, I have constantly being asked by the members of this legislature and citizens of my community to achieve better outcomes with fewer resources available to us. But while that may be what the legislature asks me to do, this legislation actually tells me that the state wishes to create a system that prevents me from exploring that. From exploring new and cost-effective partnerships or technological advancements that would produce better and cheaper outcomes to our taxpayers. Counties need flexibility to serve their residents as effectively as possible, and this would be a move away from that principle. I therefore again strongly oppose this legislation. The overreaching nature of this bill and its impacts on government and the responsibility of governments as it relates to solid waste cannot be overstated. This proposed legislation does not belong in Chapter 117, which refers to condemnation proceedings. This bill should be referring to Chapter 115, where all solid waste roles and responsibilities are laid out and then heard by this legislature, especially in the environmental committees. Even if you pass this today, I request that this opportunity to see this legislation, proposed legislation, go into the environmental committees. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee.
Thank you, sir. The opposition has about 8.5 minutes left. And we have four more people. Ms. Callison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jan Callison. I'm a member of the Hennepin County Board of Commissioners. I'm also speaking on behalf of the Solid Waste Management Coordinating Board and the Association of Minnesota Counties. Some background. We manage solid waste in Minnesota in order to promote public health and protect the environment. We do so at the state level by setting goals and then asking counties to meet them. Our system requires both public and private participation. Counties' ability to meet these goals depends directly upon the state, both in terms of resources provided by the state, the regulatory actions taken by the state, and the powers given to us by the state. As we manage waste, we also respond to the expectations of our residents and businesses, our constituents. By our involvement, we remove a potentially tremendous financial burden from the hauling industry. Senate File 1664 will calcify the existing environment and significantly overreaches the issue of organized collection. If this bill becomes law, a county, and by extension its taxpayers, would face significant payouts any time that county modified its existing solid waste policies. This would create a system that reduces the ability of locally elected officials to respond to their constituents, where residents would be left complaining to commissioners and local officials about a local issue over which they have no control, and where counties would be unable to encourage and adopt more effective and efficient solid waste management practices in the years ahead. In addition to the negative implications for the public sector, trash haulers will benefit from a level of governmental financial protection that leaves them with little incentive to ever modify their practices or cost structures. And I therefore suggest that this bill leads to a stagnant future that will require our entire system of waste management in Minnesota to be completely reexamined. In fact, if this passes, it will increasingly make sense to the counties that the trash hauling industry should be responsible for the state's environmental goals, not us. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Callison. Mr. Dave Perkins and John Helmers.
Mr. Chair, my name is Dave Perkins. I'm an Olmsted County Commissioner. I've been a commissioner for over 9 years, and I'm also here representing the Minnesota Resource Recovery Association, which I chair. In the past, the legislative have gave the counties the obligation to manage solid waste, and it provided valuable tools to the work. And I, along with the county commissioners around the state and work with not only our county government, but we work with city and townships to undermine our important tools that were organized in solid waste collection. Now, if the legislator wants counties to continue to provide sound, economically viable, environmental protective solid waste management programs as mandated, we need to be provided with the necessary tools to get the job done. Counties could potentially face some liability if we do not carry out this state-mandated responsibility. This bill has larger implications than that we go beyond the solid waste management system. If this concept expands beyond solid waste, it could have adverse impact on a wide variety of local government activities. What would be the next special interest that would point to this bill and ask for similar treatment? What will be the next thing that government does for the public good? Perhaps what the state has mandated the county can do could be challenged. What will be the cost to the taxpayers to compensate private companies? As an elected official who works hard to comply with our state mandated responsibilities, I feel this bill sets a dangerous precedent and potentially opens counties up to a number of legal issues. As a county commissioner, I'm always looking at ways to reduce the cost of county government, and a lot of that is privatizing certain services that we provide. If this bill passes, I don't think I could support privatizing anything out of our county with the fear that we might have to have legal and compensate. So I thank you for hearing my concerns.
Thank you, Mr. Perkins. Mr. Perkins, the Minnesota Resource Recovery, we're not an environmental committee,
no.
And I'm unfamiliar with Minnesota Resource Recovery. Is that a government entity?
Yes, we represent the waste energy that burn waste energy within the
and
state.
And you're the chairman of that organization?
Yes.
All right. Thank you, sir. Mr. Helmers. And we have about 4 minutes left for Mr. Helmers and Mr. David Benke. Mr. Helmers?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is John Helmers. I'm the director of the Environmental Resources Department for Olmsted County, and I also serve on the executive board of the Solid Waste Administrators Association, which is an affiliate of the Association of Minnesota Counties, and I'm here presenting their views as well. Local government units were given the authority to organize waste collection services and responsibility for waste management programs within their regions under Waste Management Act 115A and the Public Health 145A statutes in order to provide for the health, safety, and welfare of its citizens and to protect the environment. One of the reasons why that was mandated by the state is that waste is special. Unlike other things, its ownership doesn't change hands. When you hire a hauler to take your waste away, that business does not take ownership of that waste. It remains with you, the generator, and along with any future liabilities for that waste. This bill before you today hinders solid waste administrators when working with their local units of government to fulfill these various statutory responsibilities. and particularly to protect environmentally, we've instituted waste management systems that prevent those future liabilities. While we solid waste administrators oppose the concept of inverse condemnation, if this language of this bill is particularly concerning, some of the terms in this legislation don't have legal definitions. Without knowing what mixed municipal solid waste services is defined as, could potentially impact a number of areas that counties contract in: collections, processing, landfilling, household and small business hazardous waste collection systems, to name a few. These are things that the counties are doing because private businesses will not do them because they don't make any money at them. But they're still particularly important services for our communities. The words direct and indirect in this bill also raise questions. Because counties support the backbone of solid waste activities in the state, we have questions how this bill would impact facilities and programs that are in place that we've invested in order to carry out our responsibilities. Due to languages, placement in Chapter 117, we have additional concerns how the eminent domain may come into play. On behalf of all solid waste administrators of the state, I request a further examination of the unclear definitions as well as the eminent domain implementation issues occur before this bill moves forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Director Helmers. Mr. Benke, or Director Benke. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Would you identify yourself for the record, please?
My name is David Benke. I'm the Director of the Resource Management and Assistance Division at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. My division oversees the issues related to solid waste management. You can call them garbage, trash, whatever you want to do, but that's what we oversee. And then you might talk about those as kind of a simple word, but it's a complex issue, as we've already heard today. The agency opposes the bill, I think, mainly because we believe that the state has placed solid waste management at the appropriate level with local units of government. The local decisions are directly connected to the local impacts and the citizens of the community. The statutes have provided the local units of government with a set of tools to help Minnesota manage waste properly, to reduce the waste, reuse it, recycle materials, and recover from those waste resources and energy, and ultimately dispose what we can't use. It's all there, it's all connected in the statutes, and it's connected in a way that you can't just start in one statute and not find yourself led to other places quite quickly, as other testifiers have mentioned. The decision-making process, though, I think is the real important one to think about. Anytime a local unit takes an action, especially when taking an action that affects existing business contracts and arrangements, that local unit needs to pay extra attention to both documenting and discussing the solid need and public process for the action. That current process makes it clear and as it currently exists. So the changes proposed today will likely make organized collection and potentially other services that a local unit might provide in the future nearly impossible to implement. It'll take away one or more tools, making it even harder for the level of government we have chosen to assure that waste is managed properly to continue to do their job. Organized collection has happened once in the last 20 years. I think there's been probably a lot more discussions that the process has encouraged where they've come to other alternatives. If you think about organized collection in Minnesota, about 30% of our cities are organized. Nationally, that's over 70%. So with that, I will conclude my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Director. We'll be opening this up for discussion. Senator Ortman, did you want to start?
Mr. Chair, I did think that an oral amendment was appropriate to make sure everyone knows that we're talking about haulers. And I've asked Ms. Pontius to prepare to offer that, or at least to read that amendment, if
Ms. Pontius,
could.
Mr. Chairman, members, basically wherever the references are to solid waste services, it would say solid waste collection services. So if you look at page 1, line 7, before services, insert collection. And then also on line 11, 13, 16, 19, and 23, insert collection before services.
Does everyone understand the amendment? Hearing no further discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Senator Ortman?
Mr. Chair, thank you for that. I think that was an important clarification here. I listened carefully, I know you did as well, to the testimony here, and I think that this may make it a little harder for government to move from open collection to organization or back to the point where they actually control all of and provide the services to their residents. It may make it a little harder, and there may be some instances where what they're doing is essentially a government taking, and that's what we're talking about here. If there's going to be that consequence, I believe that these folks should have a right to go back in and have a court review what's happened and see if there is an actual condemnation, just as if the same government entities or others like them went in and decided that they were going to take a piece of private property for a roadway or something else. I don't see a lot of difference here, and I do think it is appropriate to have this in this committee and discussed as part of our eminent domain proceedings. This committee has worked quite a bit in changing the eminent domain law over the last few years, as long as I've been here, and I think that this is an important correction in addition to our eminent domain law.
Thank you, Senator Ortman. Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If Mr. Johnson would come forward, I'd like to ask a question of him, and maybe he's gone. Oh, there he is.
Mr. Johnson?
A couple questions maybe and a comment. Just so I understand this, Mr. Johnson, I'm not convinced of what's broken here. I'm not convinced that the cities should have this authority. Can you tell me what a city that puts out an RFP for contract and contracts for one where they normally had three? We've talked about that here. What does the city gain other than the traffic and the public safety that was talked about? Not real compelling evidence there, but what does the city gain by that? Now, we already know by statute the city's compelled to collect garbage. That's pretty simple, straightforward. Can you tell me what the city's going to gain here by this versus having three or four haulers in the same town?
Mr. Carlson.
Close, Mr. Chair. Craig Johnson, League of Minnesota Cities. If I understand your question correctly, sir, it's several things. One is I think the residents who may have a year or two longer before they have a special assessment for repair of the road in their residential neighborhood that otherwise does not have this kind of heavy traffic on it at that level would say that that is a real gain. If it's another year or two before they have to repair that road, that's a big help. But we also do gain several other things. One is under federal Superfund law, the local unit of government that is responsible for the collection of the solid waste maintains the liability for how that waste is handled. So in many cases, when you see counties and cities making decisions on how solid waste is handled in their community, part of that decision is how are we most effectively getting this to a safe place where we're not going to later have a federal Superfund claim coming against the local jurisdiction for having put it in the wrong type of facility that's not properly managed. So we use it to make sure our waste goes to properly managed facilities. It can be a public safety issue. If it's a very narrow street, very busy neighborhoods, lots of kids, playgrounds, schools, other things, communities sometimes decide that they very much need to lessen large truck traffic in their community to deal with those issues. And it can save the taxpayers in the community a significant amount on their utility bills. We have cities that, when switching to an organized collection system, have saved over $1 million a year for their residents on their garbage bills.
And a follow-up.
Yes, Senator Ingebrigtsen.
To that point, so you're telling me that by the city actually going into a contract by themselves with a single provider, carrier, that they're actually going to save money. The city's going to save money. Or they're going to... You know, at least in my area, I can take it. I have a decision, I think, on three different haulers. And the cost got a little high with one of the haulers. I called them up. I said, can you do better? No, I can't. So I called somebody different. Where are you telling me that the city's liability is going to change by just having one hauler versus three? Am I missing something?
Mr. Carlson?
Mr. Chair, Johnson. Senator, the change Johnson. In liability is is that as part of the condition of the RFP for putting out the bids, and whether it's one hauler or whether the city decides we're going to have three haulers and we're going to, you know, contract three haulers in this community, and maybe it used to be four or six, you know, whatever. In those cases, the conditions of the RFP can set up the various requirements. So you can say, you know, what types of facilities it has to be brought to. You can say what days of the week they have to provide service on. You can have them negotiate what rate they're going to be charging. All of those things get worked out as part of the contract, and it's a low-bid contract system, the way that government is told to do our bidding to make it most rewarding to the most efficient business interest.
Real quickly, if I can. Obviously, it's not very clear with me, but so what you're saying, then, the liability doesn't shift to the three haulers. In other words, the city has that constant liability? And for the end user? And then my last question is, I have solid waste energy facilities in my district, one now and soon to have a new one, that actually burn garbage. And they contract with other counties and cities. I'm assuming that's how they get their additional garbage, because they're willing to do that. How is this going to affect that?
Senator Johnson. Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Senator, on the first part, the hauler would have liability if they are intentionally doing something wrong with the waste. If they are doing something they shouldn't be doing, they'd have liability. That's very rare. These are good business people. So where the city's liability is, or the county's, is that for the we are statutorily required to manage the waste. And so the liability for the waste from our communities travels with it. We have the state right now has liability for a whole lot of closed landfills in the state of Minnesota. The reason the state is managing those is to make sure that they don't leach out, cause groundwater contamination, and end up having the municipalities and the counties in the state with huge amounts of fiscal liability for cleaning up Superfund sites. Sorry, Senator.
Solid waste energy.
Mr. Chair, the waste energy facilities regularly use organized collection as a way to make sure that their facilities can operate. To have a successful facility that regularly handles enough waste to be efficient, they need a pretty broad sweep of contracts from a wide range of areas. The way those communities can do that is to have a requirement in their service contracts with haulers that you need to bring the waste to this facility. So they make those arrangements, they organize the collection to provide that waste stream flow to those facilities. Under this, if a hauler said, no, I don't want to, and the community said, well, then you can't collect waste here anymore because we have a publicly owned facility that we are channeling waste to, that would fall under this exemption of limiting their participation as a waste hauler in the community.
Members, we seem to have a lot of interest in this issue. Everyone must be an expert in this subject matter. But I've got Senator Jungbauer, Latz, McGuire, Goodwin, Marty, and Hoffman all wanting to contribute to the conversation, and I only warn them, let's talk about the bill, inverse condemnation. So, Senator Jungbauer, could you ask your question?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and there's so many things in order to try to get your hands around what the cities and counties are trying to tell us, because what I know about the business today and what I know about that the private individuals can do, the cities and the counties don't allow them to do. We can separate out the garbage so we don't have contamination anymore, but cities and counties won't allow that zoning, and they want this control over everybody so that they can't haul out of their cities or they can dictate who hauls out of there. So I'm trying to figure out, what kind of control do the cities want when we know how to take care of all this garbage, when the technology's out there, so that we don't cause contamination? Why do cities not allow these stations to separate out the garbage to control the liability? So why are you fighting this inverse condemnation? It doesn't make any sense to me. There is a profit to be made in garbage, but cities and counties don't allow that kind of things to go on. And so this whole bill seems to be dealing with allowing these private individuals to have access to the business so that they can do what needs to be done and done right that counties and cities can't afford to do. And yet you're fighting and trying to throw them out on the street. It just seems like with this bill is a good thing, I think.
Senator Jungbauer, was that a question?
There's so many things that play into this. So it's when you deal with the inverse condemnation, if you kick a business out on the street, you should be responsible for that. And somebody came up, and maybe PCA, and said that these folks can't take care of the garbage. Well, that's not true. And in fact, the cities aren't taking care of the garbage. There is a profit to be made in separating garbage out and doing different things with this. So I get there's all this conflicting testimony that I know to be false from the side that doesn't like the bill. And I don't know where to start with all that conflicting and false testimony.
All right. Sarah Latz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question, first of all, kind of a technical question about the amendment that was added. If I'm reading it correctly, and maybe counsel can correct me, but it looks like on line 1.8 that was not amended, there's also reference to a person, and I inquire whether or not that should also have been expanded to include a corporation or association, et cetera.
Senator Ortman, do you have a comment on that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Latz, I think that's correct. Now that I'm looking at it, it probably does need to be changed there. I appreciate your picking that up.
Senator Latz, could you repeat the reference of what you would like to add as a technical amendment?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, on line 1.8 after the word person, to amend as follows, comma, or a corporation or association in which the person is a shareholder or member, comma.
Senator Latz moves at the previous oral amendment. Is there any discussion? Senator Ortman, you agreed that that's a friendly amendment?
Yes, sir.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Senator Latz, do you have any other question?
Thank you. Your Honor, I see there are some references to person in other places that were also not amended. I'm not sure if they also need to be corrected, but I'll leave that to
we'll
counsel.
We'll instruct the counsel to make changes as necessary.
1.15, 1.18,
1.21,
2.1, 1.22. Did council get those references?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members, I received this amendment from someone else, and I know there were. I'm not sure if it needs to be in all the places or not.
Could we?
Or maybe there needs to be a definition of person at the beginning to make sure it's covered. And I mean, I'll leave it to council to fashion, you know, whatever needs to be cleaned up in this regard. But I do also want to note that this bill does recognize a difference between a person and a corporation, which I'm very happy to see recognized here.
We're entering dangerous ground, sir.
I hope that means you'll support it, Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman, I note that we have an extremely accelerated statute of limitations, which is now part of this bill from that amendment, which raises its own issues. The day you've got a garbage collector that on day 181 decides they need to bring that action because they've figured out that they've got a cause of action, I guess we'll be back here again looking to expand that statute of limitations. But
Sir Latz, did you have an idea of changing or suggesting a different statute of limitation?
Not on that one, Mr. Chairman. But I think we do need to be cognizant of the role this committee is supposed to be playing with regard to some of these statutes. I'm not sure that this bill, whether or not you agree with the policy, is ready to be advanced. We've already heard some testimony on the impact that this may have on expanding localities, such as the St. Cloud and the Shakopee example that was given, and how the statutes that provide for that or the impact of that might need to be addressed in some manner in this bill. Otherwise, it sets up an automatic inverse condemnation proceeding or mandate just from the act of expanding the municipal boundaries or the local boundaries. From the testimony and from my review, it appears that it directly contradicts some parts of Chapter 115A that would need to be dealt with. Sounds like, at least some of the testimony, that it would sets up an inverse condemnation situation just for the municipality complying with state mandates contained in 115A. Certainly that question has been raised and it hasn't been answered to my satisfaction. This is the committee that needs to sort that out, it seems to me. It also seems to be shoehorning into a real property proceeding, the eminent domain statute, a clearly non-real property kind of situation. We're getting into the issue of valuing businesses here and the eminent domain proceedings have all sorts of requirements in it that just don't fit well with valuing businesses. There's loss of going concern, something that's involved here. How will a real estate appraiser put a value on this property? The eminent domain statute deals with real estate appraisers most specifically. You're creating an inverse, a mandate to negotiate in good faith, which is in the eminent domain statute. But how do you establish a good faith negotiation when you've got a mandated inverse condemnation proceeding? I mean, you can't have a meaningful negotiation when you've got a mandate set up on one side of the negotiating table. There are appraisal requirements for commercial properties. How does this dovetail into that? Will relocation assistance and benefits need to be paid to a hauler that's objecting to it? Those are mandated payments under the real property provisions in the eminent domain statute. How do you deal more with all the intangible assets other than just the value of real property, such as the loss of goodwill? What about businesses that consist largely of mobile equipment, which could be moved, have a value, it could be moved to be used in some other location, which is different than real property? These are all, and there's an attorney's fees award provision in the eminent domain statute, which kicks in when there's a mandatory, when there's an award that exceeds an offer by more than 40%. And when you're dealing with business valuation, which will be harder than real property valuation to get a real hard number on, you're setting up an even greater penalty, an attorney's fees award that might be involved here as well. So those are some of the reasons. Someone else mentioned Superfund as an issue too, and I'm nervous about some of the implications here as to the Superfund mandates exposure of our municipalities also. I just wanted to call members' attention to a couple of points in the PCA's submission. The table on the first page shows roughly a one-third reduced rate of collection payable by the residents when there's an organized collection compared to an open collection system. So if you're concerned about the financial impact on your constituents or your communities, there's a big difference there on a monthly rate. So you're talking hundreds of dollars a year. And that does not go to the question of property assessments for road repair. And also this will have an impact on recycling as well. And you can see on the second page of the PCA how organized collection systems for recycling looks like almost a 20% higher rate of recycling collection than does the open system. So from an environmental standpoint as well, there leaves a bit to be desired here. And really, this is opening up a huge door that I'm nervous about. Talk about the camel's nose under the tent. This opens up the whole process to regulatory changes that have an impact on business being subject to inverse condemnation proceedings. And, at what point does a regulatory change become just a change in business altogether? It's even, the ambiguity is even shown in the language we have before us. Is it if the hauler is going to go out of business, if the hauler is going to lose 20% of their business, if they're going to lose 80% of their business, at what point does inverse condemnation take effect? And how does that affect other businesses as well? You start looking at every other business you've got in the community. What about municipalities that have a contract with Office Max to provide their office supplies? And they decide they can get a better deal from Office Depot, so next year they're going to switch to Office Depot. Maybe the local Office Max in their community is going to lose 20% of their business because the municipality changed that particular private contract. Pick your supplier. Pick your service. Municipal private attorneys that provide prosecution services. You're opening up the door. We're a law firm that 50% of their business is providing private prosecution services to Mound, for example. They'd have just as much a moral claim to
to inverse condemnation if the city decided to change prosecutors, as the garbage haulers would be claiming here if the city decided to make a change in their process. I don't know how you draw the distinction. Boy, this is a much bigger discussion than we can have in the next 10 or 15 minutes, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, especially at the rate we're going, Senator Latz.
Well, these are a lot of questions, Mr.
Well,
Chairman.
Well, Senator Latz, just for your information, the bill will be going to local government if it's passed here, and it may even take a side trip to environment as well. Senator Ortman, did you have any comments?
Well, Mr. Chair, those were an awful lot of questions, but I wanted to point out that mostly in the condemnation proceedings, they'll have the answers. I mean, they're going to do a fair market valuation and decide how to properly compensate a business that's lost its business. But this is really about the government takeover of the private sector business, and maybe that's a good thing, but it's certainly in Minnesota law. One of the testifiers here said that we already have 30% of our communities that are doing organized collection. Once they're in, there's no liability. If they're already providing services here, there's no liability. So all we're talking about now is the transition from what is open collection to some other type of service. And there isn't necessarily a reason why folks can't negotiate. In fact, that's been happening throughout these communities. They've been finding a way to negotiate their differences, all except in Maplewood. But I have to say, to Senator Latz's point, if he says that it would be holding the cities hostage, I'm not sure that's exactly what you said, but something to that extent, that these garbage haulers would then have all the power, I disagree. Because without the right of action, they currently are completely powerless. They have no way to do anything but take it or leave it according to what the city says. If the city says, I'm sorry, but we're moving to 3 haulers, take it or leave it. You have no rights. There's nothing that you can do in response. And this provides that, an opportunity for review of that decision and the impact on the business owner. And I do think the local government committee is the perfect place to review the question about what happens with expanding cities. I think that's a great place for it, and we will continue to work on that because I think that's a very good question.
Sarah McGuire.
Thank you, Ms. Drink some water. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I echo many of the same concerns that Senator Latz has about. I'm trying to stay on the scope of the review of this committee and judiciary, and I'm glad that I will be seeing it in local government. I wish I was on Environment Committee because I have a lot of questions on that and the impact there also. So I don't know, Mr. Chair, if it's your intent to move it out of here, but I need to know more about what this, what the implications are for inverse condemnation. I understand that it broadly expands that scope, and so that means there's broad implications to this. So I just don't know enough about that to understand that. And so, if I can start to ask some questions about that, I don't know if you're planning to pass this out of here. But first of all, are there any other states that have done this, and what would be the implications? And what have been the implications there?
Senator Ortman?
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, I don't know, but maybe council can look at that and provide you the information.
I'm not sure if council knows what other states have done in this area. Do you have any other questions, Senator McGuire?
Excuse me. Okay, so I just have general questions about, I live in Falcon Heights, actually, and they are one of the ones where I really wanted organized waste collection because I live on a dead-end street, and three or four garbage haulers come down servicing 10 houses. We just have 5 on one side and 5 on the other, and like 3 or 4 garbage haulers. And I understand that I could organize myself and get us all to be using the same one, but that's, you know, that would take time, and we aren't doing that. So I am worried about the impact on the road, but I guess that's not for this committee. I don't know what committee would that be in, Mr. Chair, that I would ask about the impact on the road and the cost to our cities about
local government would probably
okay. So I'll ask that question again there, but in Falcon Heights they decided that they weren't going to go with organized collection. So I understand, you know, that's that. But if they had decided to do that, then just so I understand this, every hauler that had done business in Falcon Heights would then be able to sue Falcon Heights for the damages of not being able to do business there. Is that what your bill says? Senator Ortman.
Sorry, I got a little distracted. I apologize to the committee. Yeah. Senator McGuire, are you asking if the city decided to organize and reduce the number of haulers that can service your street?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Well, if the city decides that it's only going to license three, and there are five currently, those two that lose out can either negotiate with the city, which is what's been happening across the state for the most part, or those two that lose out can consider, did they have a significant of enough of a loss that they want to go through a condemnation proceeding. If they do, then they can bring the action. Obviously, the notice period is very quick. And then they can go on to the condemnation proceedings. There's no guarantee that they will recover anything, but there's a place for them to bring their concerns and provide evidence to say that they have lost a significant portion of their business and should be compensated.
So, Mr. Chair, if I could ask a follow-up.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then that would limit the ability of the city to contract with who they want to contract with. By that, I mean,
well,
they can
Chair,
contract with it, but no. Then they have recourse. And
right.
Do they not already have any?
Senator Ortman.
Senator McGuire, they have all the authority that they would want or need to organize. There's nothing that would impair that. In fact, years ago we talked about whether there should be a prohibition prohibiting these cities and counties from doing this, and the agreement was no, let's encourage them to do this if that's what they want. But I think that we have to recognize that this is still a government taking, and there should be some venue for review if a business believes that the government has just taken its business.
I'll just move on to one more question, Mr. Chair. I mean, I have a lot of them, but I'll just ask one more. Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I have a, I actually just don't know that much about the implications of this, so I'm just going through examples in my mind. So if we had, we have a shopping area in my city, and they decided to make that into a residential area. So they decided to, to zone that for a different purpose. So then if we pass a bill like this, would that, I know it doesn't have to do with waste hauling, but we're setting a precedent then for cities who, or any business in my city, if they suddenly lose business in my city, then they could organize a bill and say, well, we're going to follow the inverse condemnation practices of this bill and say that if you take away my business by rezoning, then I can sue you for the loss of my business.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that would be an expansive reading of what this bill would do. But if you're taking someone's private property already under Minnesota law, the government has to compensate them for the value of the loss. That is condemnation, and we do have that under current Minnesota law.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ortman, I guess when you're calling it a taking, I think last year when we were talking about local government aid cuts and you were asking, you're saying how these cities don't have to raise taxes, they can be more efficient. And I remember discussing with you how one of my cities is very little option there to the point of they'll cut back no police cars instead of one. You said contract with another city. Well, that's what they're doing. They can't afford to contract the full time on that. And when they look at this, I mean, the city I live in is quoted in the PCA study as $20 to $40 a year in road cost per year per household. That's huge. Plus, they're saying in Maplewood, and I don't know, I know it was just last year, but they're saying 50% savings for customers. I understand that you want to make sure that people want to pay more to have their own choice of hauler. They could do that. But again, my street has 5-6 haulers coming down every Wednesday. We got lots of little kids, only one school bus, but 5 or 6 garbage trucks. I worry about the safety, the air quality, all those things, which cost the cities a lot of money for the road stuff. And what I don't get is why, if the city decides we're going to go from these 6 haulers, and I don't care if they decide the city cut the city into 4 zones or 6 zones or whatever, say we'll bid out each of those, and then the haulers, some of them win the bids and some of them lose the bids, and why the losing bidders have a taking, because it is going to be a competitively bid process. I assume I don't know what Maplewood did. I assume they competitively bid it. You're in effect saying because we had this share and now that it's being bid out and we lose, we shouldn't be able to do that.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ortman.
Senator Marty, I think that's a really good question, and let me answer it this way. If I have a business with 10,000 customers across the metro area, that business is worth a lot. And I can probably package up all of the assets and all those customers with their goodwill and all of the money that they pay in every month for those services, and I could probably package it up and sell it to somebody else. But if the cities instead step in one at a time and take my customer base, my business is not worth as much. And I lose the value of all those revenues and all of my investments. And so that's why we're saying it's just like if there were a piece of property in that city and the government stepped in and said, I'm going to take it and we're going to develop it like they did with Best Buy, with the car dealership in Richfield, if you remember. And then the government, the court stepped in and said, wait a minute, this is a condemnation and there should be some compensation for all of that value that you've just taken out of this business's portfolio, if you will.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Marty,
Senator Ortman, on that case, it was a case of a car dealership having their land taken so that the city could give it to another project. This is a case where the city's saying, we're taking you 5-6 haulers and we're going to bid it out. And if you win the bid, you'll get more customers. If you lose the bid, you'll get less. If we decide we're going to divide it into 4 zones, some are you going to win, some are going to lose. Maybe one company's going to win all of it. I don't know. I think that's up to the way the city wants to do it. But why, in effect, they're saying we're going to bid it out. We're going to bid it out in a logical way so we don't have all the damage to our roads. And you're saying, well, no, if you're going to bid it out to somebody, then everybody else who doesn't win the bid is a loser, and therefore they can sue. Is a taking, and I guess I just see it as a totally different situation.
Mr. Chair, if I could, I think that's the policy question before us. Do you see this as a taking or not? And I propose this bill because I see it as a taking.
Senator Ortman, we'll be asking the committee to make a decision on that in a few minutes. But Senator Goodwin, you're next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Ortman. I've had a lot of concern on behalf of my cities about this, and I've been hearing from them pretty regularly here. I think one of the things that we all want to do around here is to decrease the number of local mandates, and I've heard that from your party as well as mine. But this is going to be a local mandate that has a potentially heavy legal cost involved with it, for one thing. Possible street damage involved with it, for another thing. Possible additional costs for private haulers to allow several private haulers there at the same time. And another concern is that, you know, we could be opening up a can of worms here because the current law spells out the contracting process for local governments as well as state government. And if we're going to say that that we're not going to go by competitive bidding or whatever, we're going to have to, for perpetuity, keep the same small haulers unless they break the law or do something that they shouldn't do. We have to forever keep those small haulers. We're really tying the hands of local government and in counties as well. And I think this is one of probably the most damaging local mandates we've had. The cities, the city officials and the county officials are all elected officials, and if they're not doing the right thing on this is a big deal. People call them and complain about haulers all the time and about what happened and what they left behind and so forth, and their reelection depends often on whether or not they satisfy their constituents, just like we try to do here. So I think this is another case of really interfering in the business of other elected officials. I do sympathize with the small haulers. I do feel bad for them, and I do think that they have a right to go out and compete for these contracts wherever they can. And it was really unfortunate what happened to our testifier, and he lost 20% of his business. That's very, very unfortunate. But, you know, it's a competitive market, and there are other cities he can go to compete for some more business and build his business back up again. So, you know, they have the right to bid on those contracts right now, and what we're doing is saying you won't have the right to bid on those contracts if the companies they already have are going to have to stay in business forever unless they break a law or something, and that's basically what we're setting up here. So I think, you know, there may be something we can do for those small haulers. I'm not sure that this extensive of action is appropriate right now, and I'm thinking that we really need to see a fiscal note on this as close as we can get to some kind of cost for our local governments. I don't know if you have that, Senator Ortman, and I know it would be very hard to evaluate that, but maybe some way we could at least get some information about that, because we're looking at the streets, we're looking at the lawsuits, we're looking at the the contracting issue, whether or not they contract on best value or lowest price or whatever, and then they have to abide by the contracting language and statutes. So they're going to have to contract out for this stuff, and they're going to be opening those contracts again, I don't know, annually or at once every 2 years or whatever they contract, once every 5 years, whatever they contract for. So there are a number of issues here that we really do, I think, need to get answers to before this goes anywhere. And I think, Mr. Chair, this should go to transportation, too, because they have all kinds of information at MnDOT about how much weight on roads causes problems. And they could talk in that committee about that issue alone, because it is an issue.
Thank you, Senator Goodwin. We've had a very robust discussion about waste in the Judiciary Committee, and I don't think we can really add too much more to the discussion. Is there anyone that wishes to make any further discussion about this? Because we would like to bring this to a vote. Senator Latz?
Mr. Chairman, a couple of thoughts, and Senator Marty held up a sign to me. He said this is a trial lawyer's bill. I think that's true. Thank you, Senator Ortman. I'm sure the trial lawyers will support this. There'll be a lot more lawsuits if this happens. It also sounds like it's an anti-competitive carve-out for people that currently are doing business in a community. And it would. When I was on the St. Louis Park City Council, we went out to open bid on our one waste haul contract, saved our residents $500,000 in costs, and we improved the recycling process in the community. So this... That whole concept is being done damage here. But I haven't heard one answer to my questions about how this bill would interplay with the eminent domain statute and the other provisions in the eminent domain statute. And I think if there is any duty incumbent upon the Judiciary Committee, it's to make sure that we don't do something that makes a mess out of the eminent domain statute or that brings something into it that doesn't really fit there at all. So I would like to have some answers to those questions, if I might, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Ortman?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm not aware, other than we're adding an additional cause of action to our eminent domain statute for this purpose. And with respect to your savings in your city, Senator Latz, I'm sure that's a great thing and a great achievement for the city and the customers, but at what expense? And it's at the expense of the customers of a business that has built and serviced those customers. I think that's the question here.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
Senator Latz,
if I might, let's just legislate profits then for every business. I mean, that's essentially what this bill is trying to do. At the expense of the profits for the businesses, all right, that's another way of saying we're going to fence out all the competition. We're going to lock in those who already have business in an area. We're going to make sure no one else can come in or the contractors can't be changed. We're going to be guaranteeing profits for the businesses. So I think it sounds to me like it's the exact opposite direction than we'd like to be going. But I guess I'm not going to get an answer to my questions about how the eminent domain statute as a whole, which addresses real property, fits with this. If this committee wants to abdicate its responsibility to figure those questions out before we vote on it, I guess that's this committee's choice.
As I said, Senator Latz, this has got a few more stops on the way to go.
Mr. Chair, does Council know the answer to some of these questions? Like, how does this impact the eminent domain statute?
Well, Mr. Chair, with all due respect, I did answer the question.
Right. You said you didn't know if it did.
No, Mr. Chair, I said that it adds a cause of action to the current eminent domain statute. And then once a cause of action is brought, then the process that's followed is what's under current law.
This is kind of making the gun bills kind of tame, all this waste that we're talking about. Hearing no further discussion, all those in favor...
Mr. Chair, I want to make that motion. I don't think it's been made on the
record
yet.
Oh, you need to make a motion. Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, I would move that Senate File 1664 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the local government committee.
Hearing no further discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed?
No.
No.
Motion does prevail.
Division.
Motion is adopted.
Thank you, Mayor.
A division has been requested. All those in favor, raise your hands.
Oops. Thank you, Pat. I'm on our side.
I don't want to vote. And those opposed, raise your hand. The motion does prevail. The motion is adopted at an 8-5 vote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Senator Ortman. Senator, there are some members that have to leave to other committees, but we are going to continue with the two remaining bills on the agenda. Senator Latz, your bill is up next, Senate File 1895.
Good afternoon, sir.
Senator Latz, do you have a bill as controversial as human waste?
Not at all, Mr. Chairman.
All right.
Mr. Chairman, Senate File 1895 is intended to make it more simple for businesses to advertise and use their name as they are marketing and so on. It has specifically to do with a provision in Chapter 333. Right now, they're required to include the legal entity designation when they use that when they're using their assumed names, such as Inc. for Incorporated, seems to me it ought not to be necessary to do that in their logos and so on. So I've introduced the bill. I do have an author's amendment at the recommendation of counsel to include descriptions of the statutes that are referenced in the bill. So I move the A1 amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Latz moves the A1 amendment as an author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chairman, Latz. I do have with me Bert Black, the legal advisor to the Secretary of State's office, to testify in support of the bill.
Mr. Black, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senators. I'm Bert Black, the legal advisor for the Office of the Secretary of State, and this marks now 33 consecutive sessions I've been before the committee. Let me give you an example of how this particular bill will work for businesses. If you are already incorporated as, let's say, ABC Inc., if you're already incorporated, you're going to be on file with the Office of the Secretary of State because you'll have to file your articles of incorporation with us. That'll put you into our database. Let's assume that you are doing business with the public as ABC. The purpose of the assumed name law is to allow members of the public to find out who they're really doing business with. Because of the way that our search mechanisms work, if you go online to our webpage, you can do a search of any name and find out who's doing business under that name. If you, as a citizen, as a consumer, only know the business as ABC, if you put in ABC, you will find ABC Inc., which is the actual legal entity that you're doing business with. And so that will serve the purpose for the consumer of being able to find out exactly who it is that they're really doing business with. The assumed name filing that we are hopefully eliminating here does not add any real information. Basically, the assumed name filing would say, okay, I'm doing item one. The name I'm doing business under is ABC. The owner of that name, or the company doing business under that name, is ABC Inc. at the registered office. Well, the corporate name and the registered office are already on file. That's all the information we collect in an assumed name. So it's simply, at this point, a duplicative filing with no particular informational usefulness. Now, this only works, that's why this you'll note that this only addresses situations where the corporate ending is at the end of the name, and that's because the search will only be assured of bringing up that company if we're simply taking out the Inc. or Corp. or company at the end of the name. If it's in the middle of the name, then that's a little more problematical, and you won't find the organization, company, LLC, whatever, that you're looking for. So, again, just to simplify the filing process, take away the requirement for a duplicate filing, which really adds no particular information. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions? Mr. Black, if as a result of this bill, if let's say there's a company called Bob's Garage Incorporated, this would allow Garage Incorporated to act as simply Bob's Garage?
That is correct, without having to file an assumed name.
And what if there's another entity that's Bob's Garage LLC? Can they also work as Bob's Garage as well?
They could, but Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, they could. But we already have that situation because under Chapter 333, which is the assumed name statutes, duplicate assumed names are permitted and have been permitted for the last, well, at least 97 years. So, and the original reason for that was it's a big state. You know, there can't be just one Joe's Bar or Bob's Garage in the whole state. You can have one in Winona and one in Halleck. They'd never know about each other. And so the decision was made to allow duplicates. Now, if, in fact, they're infringing on each other's commercial territory, that gets into another kind of another area which is really pursued through the courts, and that would be name infringement. And that's an intellectual property, more of an intellectual property situation. And if, in fact, they were, if there was confusion, actual confusion between the customers, then one of them would send a nasty letter to the other and try and negotiate something out. And if there were no response, then you would, one of them could consider taking that to court. And we've had that, that's not new, we've had that in Minnesota for many years. It hasn't been used all that much, but it certainly is possible. But we already have that situation.
I received one of those nasty letters for a filing that I did.
Did you really?
And like all authority figures, I just simply ignored it. But is there any further discussion? Hearing none. All those or Senator Latz moves that Senate File 1895 as amended be recommended to pass and go to the floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Latz.
Thank you. I will not ignore the authority of the chairman. Senator Limmer, you have Senate File 2060, a revisor's bill, as I
understand.
That's
right.
Please proceed, Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chairman, the dreaded revisor bill comes upon us once a year, and as usual, I have a representative from the revisor's bill to explain it. And I'm going to hand it off to Ms. Timmons.
Ms. Timmons.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I'm Michelle Timmons, the Revisor of Statutes, and this is the annual revisor's bill. This is the one that corrects errors from past sessions of the legislature. It does not address anything that you've done in this 2012 session. This is the one that focuses on the past. And this year, we've prepared a bill with three articles. Article 1 corrects a number of miscellaneous errors. Most of them are cross-reference errors where the statute cross-references an erroneous statute, and we're correcting that. But there are also some changes in grammar, syntax, misspellings, things of that nature. Article 2 adds cross-references within Chapter 13 on data practices that summarize data practices classifications that are made elsewhere in the statutes. So those are just cross-references added for the user of the statutes to understand where there are other references. Those are not substantive. Article 3 corrects references in statutes to the Revised Minnesota Board of Social Work Practice Act in Minnesota Statutes Chapter 148E, which replaced Chapter 148D effective August 1st of 2011. And so that really summarizes the types of changes that are in the revisor's bill this year. And I'll stand for any questions.
Members have any questions of Ms. Timmons? Senator Limmer, to your motion.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move that Senate File Number 2060 be recommended to pass and be moved to the floor.
Senator Limmer has moved Senate File 2060 be recommended to pass and be moved to the floor. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Senator Limmer, you have been successful. Your motion, your bill is on the way to the floor.
I just have one comment because it's the only time
Senator
we get
Goodwin.
To tell. Mr. Chair, I just have one comment, and that's because it's the only time of year we get to tell the revisors what a great job they do. And
thank you.
It's not easy, and I know we push everybody real hard, especially at the beginning and the end of session when you have to put all those bills together. So thanks for your work.
Thank you on behalf of all the staff in the revisor's office.
Thank you for reminding us of that, Senator.
There being, do you have anything further? No. There being no further business before the Senate Judiciary and Public Safety Committee, we stand adjourned.